Welcome back to Horoscope Witch. It's Mal. And today on episode 53, I was honored and blessed to be graced by the presence of Jesse Huntenberg. So if you don't know who Jesse Huntenberg is, Jesse is a shadow worker, a YouTube witchcraft queen. She's a coven leader, a tarot reader, and so much more. Jesse has a special place in my heart because I feel like when I was really first waking up, becoming curious about witchcraft, the first thing I did was really like go on YouTube and kind of see what kind of content was out there. And I always gravitated towards Jesse and what she had to say, just because she put witchcraft in such like a no bullshit package, I guess. For me, it wasn't filled with frills or elaborate recipes or anything along those lines. Jesse just really has a knack for talking about witchcraft from a more psychological perspective, I suppose. And something else that I always resonated with when it comes to all of Jesse's content is her emphasis on mental health. And she's really helped me in that way, sharing her mental health journey. She's helped me with my own, and I've had realizations from certain things that she has said about her own journey. So I really wanted to have her on for a while. I feel like I didn't feel like I was cool enough to ask her on for like a couple months, but I finally just was like, you know what? What do we got to lose? So I asked her to be on the show, and yeah, we kind of explored a little bit more about how we can use magic for our mental health, how we can use ritual to improve our state of mind. We also talked about just shadow work. What is it? If you're not familiar with, you know, the topic, Jesse really goes into what her definition of shadow work is. We also talked about how certain mental health challenges are passed through the ancestral lineage. And specifically, Jesse sort of defines her, I guess, mental health challenge as malaise. So we go into that too, which was really, really interesting. And the best part of this episode, I think, is when we kind of explore these mental health archetypes that one can embody, specifically the spiritual warrior. So I won't say much more than that. I'll leave the interview up to you guys to listen. The one thing I'll say is that all of Jesse's information is in the show notes. So if you're interested in looking at her offerings, her website's down there, her Instagram's down there, her YouTube channel's down there. I also have a link to her Spellbound course. So towards the end of the interview, she does go into detail over, about both of her new offerings, which both have to do with witchcraft. I personally took the Spellbound course, and it was, honestly, it was so well done. It was such a helpful course. It really did change, I guess, my perspective on how exactly to create a spell. And I, in a weird way, but unsurprisingly, I felt like I had more autonomy over my own magic, I guess, after taking the course. She just has like this really great way of like giving you your power and just being like, here are some ways you can use your power. I'm not going to tell you how to use your power, but here's some ways to harness it, I suppose. So Jesse was kind enough to give me an affiliate link to her course. So I do make a small percentage off of the affiliate link if you click on it and buy her course through there. And I just want to say thank you for giving me that, Jesse. I think that's such a good idea. And you kind of gave me an idea for future offerings that I may have with different affiliates. So it's such a good way to, I don't know, lift up other colleagues and other people in the spiritual realm. So that's about all I've got today. Again, enjoy the interview. Let us know what you thought, and we'll talk later this week for the next moon sermon. See you guys. So actually, it's funny because I, of course, I've watched your YouTube channel many times. And of course, like, I think probably a lot of YouTube viewers find you like in the beginning of their journey, you know, when we're all like, oh my God, what's happening? I have to Google like witchcraft and tarot and all this stuff. So a lot of people know you for tarot, witchcraft, stuff like that. But I actually want to know like a little bit about who you were like pre YouTube, like if you had like an AD, BC, like death, rebirth, like this is way, like what happens before all of the witchcraft stuff? Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And I was definitely in a death phase before the witchcraft. I feel like so many of us who are pulled to the craft actually are pulled because we're going through it. We're going through really intense psycho-spiritual and emotional times. You know, either something has happened or we are experiencing a paradigm shift, dark night of the soul, some sort of spiritual awakening. And the case was really no different for me. I had just gone through my Saturn return. And in that time, I had gotten married, had a child, switched jobs, and moved house. So if you've ever looked at the biggest life changes that one can go through and the most stressful life changes one can go through, I think that's like four of the five. So I really did that all in 1 year. And because of that, I was just completely overwhelmed and I was feeling that I was losing myself. I was losing myself. And this is something that had been happening far, far before this. Like even now, just in retrospect, I'm realizing how long this has really gone on and how long this process has been. But I had basically come to a place where I had nothing left to lose. And it was because of that, that I was like, you know what? I'm going to sit down and I'm going to make a ritual and I'm going to cast a spell because I'm really in this space where I don't feel like I have much left to lose. And so that was the catalyst for me to make such an extreme shift. And I say extreme shift because I was like a card-carrying atheist for 15 years. So it's not even like I went from a spiritual practice to this spiritual practice. I went from like no spiritual practice, arguably, to just going like full throttle into witchcraft, like didn't look back. I just found it to be incredibly useful. I needed to get my power back and I was just moved. I was just moved to do that. I can't even tell you what it was exactly that told me that that was the right choice. I mean, I was always aware of witchcraft growing up. I didn't really live in an isolated space. There were witches in my middle school. So like I had that awareness and I had an awareness of, you know, the Wiccan path and all of that. But it just came to me. It was just like cast a spell. Like I just felt like I had so little power left over my own experience that I needed to do something drastic, like really drastic for me to begin the process of reclaiming my power in that environment.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. It was like truly a true breakdown, breakthrough. and you know, leading up to sort of this like dark night of the soul, the tower moment, like such a drastic change. How do you feel like you were managing your mental health, or where would you kind of, I should say, how would you define your sort of mental health journey up until that point? Do you feel like you were like a silent sufferer, or were you trying to kind of help yourself? Like how did that kind of come about?
I feel like I was always trying to help myself in some way. I was very aware that I was experiencing something akin to depression. I knew something was up. Like I knew from a very young age that my mental health was not stellar, as it were. And I decided to cope with that, or I was drawn to poetry, books, novels, and philosophy, theory. You know, so I would read things that would help me that's why I said, like, I kind of went kind of from no spiritual path to a spiritual path, because really what I had adopted was, you know, the Western canon. That was kind of what I was going for and trying to use to move through some of these experiences. And I kind of rejected that at the age of 22. So I was really much, very much in the wilderness years, place where I don't think my mental health was even remotely okay. I was, I was surviving. I was existing. But during that period, I was getting drunk a lot. I was detaching emotionally a lot. I really wasn't challenging myself to look at why I was where I was. I'd given up. I'd given up on trying to create these kind of breakthroughs. And I still knew that something was up, but I had kind of thought, like, well, maybe this is just what life is. It's kind of where I was. And I'm like, you know what? Maybe I'm always going to feel this way. Maybe this is just going to be how it is. And even though that like was kind of soul crushing, I just accepted it a bit as reality, until I got to the point where I was just like, no, I can't live this way. Like, I won't live this way. It was an act of defiance. Which is why I've used the phrase to be like a warrior for your wellness. It's something that, that came up organically in a video that I was shooting, and something I've, that just kind of like hit a nerve, and something I've clung to. Like my mental health journey has been a journey of, you know, exerted effort and continued effort. It was never something easy. It was never something that was going to happen on its own. It just seemed like there were so many things like stacked against me in, you know, even if it was just within my own mind, whatever the case, and even in my family and in my past and all of it. And I knew that if I was ever going to overcome it, that I would just really have to like to fight. And it's probably why the Morrigan found me very soon after I cast my first spell, the Morrigan being a warrior goddess and a goddess of sovereignty. Like, it wasn't going to happen in some kind of, balanced and calm kind of way. Like, I wasn't going to find this through meditation. And that's not to say that that is the path for everyone. There are people who turn to meditation and it just changes their lives like that. But I knew that for me, it was going to take something different. I wasn't just going to be sitting and observing. I had to fight for this.
Yeah, I relate to that so deeply. And I think, you probably attract a lot of empaths in your own practice, like, and I do too. And I find that a lot of empaths or highly sensitive people, intuitive people, who I think a lot of us dealt with depression at a very early age, because I don't think we knew what was happening, that we were regulating so many different emotions of other people in our little bodies, and we just didn't have like the awareness of what was happening. And when you do, there's something that happens when you do experience depression just from a young age. You start to just think, maybe this is me. Like, maybe this is just how my life is. Because there's like a couple different stories I hear with people's depression. Sometimes people say something happened and that caused me the depression. And other people say something along the lines of what you just said. I just remember this feeling and it became normal. And then there was like this aha moment where it was like, wait a second, this isn't me. I've almost over identified with the malaise, as the word that you use a lot in your business.
I like to use the word malaise because I like to use the word malaise because it's not clinical. So I don't always like to use the word depression, because depression is clinical. So I want to be able to include, you know, people who haven't necessarily, experienced that diagnosis. Malaise seems to be the word that makes sense and that can be the most inclusive in terms of what it is that I'm talking about.
Right. And I think malaise, to me, like if I were to just define it, it does a good job of covering that like low grade depression, where it's not like you can't get out of bed depression, but it's like that almost looming feeling that's like at the back of your, you know, shoulder or whatever, and it's just following you. I totally know what you mean by that word. Like, did you feel like there was, like, on the topic of over-identifying with our diagnoses or with just our mental health issues, did you feel like you kind of had to, like, redefine how you were viewing that? Does that question make sense?
It makes perfect sense. I had, you know, I ended up identifying with my depression in order to give it meaning. So, you know, we like to create meaning. That's what we do as human beings. And so I felt to myself, like, if I'm going to feel this way, then it has to mean something. And I kind of clung to that tortured artist, the archetype of the tortured artist, for quite some time. And that served a purpose for me. I know that looking back, I know that that may have actually saved me in some respect, because it did give what I was feeling and experiencing some meaning, and I was able to channel some of that into what I was creating. But eventually that no longer held, it no longer worked. And I realized that instead of inspiring deep creativity, it was stifling me. It wasn't really giving me much of anything. And even though I had creative flow, it never went anywhere. So like I would sit and I would write and I would purge, but then I could never really transmute that into something that I could share with others. And I think another thing we do as human beings is we communicate, we try to connect. So for a very long time, that was a very insular process. And so I didn't achieve the connection and it became empty. And when I recognized that this identification was no longer helping me, it was hindering me, I had to let it go. And I knew that I had to let that identification go if I was ever going to let myself move forward and try to achieve a sense of harmony or balance. I don't even want to use the word happiness, because I feel like happiness falls flat. Like it, what we think happiness is, isn't what it is. So it's not really a term that's useful, but so I could experience some sort of hope and possibility when it came to my own experience. So I could feel empowered and feel like that there was something that I could do, something I could make, something I could achieve, something I could co-create. And it was the healing process that did that. I feel like I hung out in terms of shadow work and the shadow journey, I feel like I hung out in shadow identification for a really long, 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 long time. Like I'd begun identifying shadows probably at the age of 12 and you know, tracing things back genealogically speaking. That was just something that I did, but I didn't really do much with that information. Like I didn't really take it anywhere. I didn't really catalyze it in terms of the healing process. So I had to like really let go of that attachment and let go of that, like, oh, this is, you know, me, I'm tortured, I've had this experience. And I had to say, you know what, that's an experience that I had, but it's not really who it is that I am. And who it is that I am is ever changing and ever shifting. And I kind of desire health more than I desire to be some kind of tortured artist or whatever it was that I was identifying with.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, it's so funny how I think we can kind of, in a way, sometimes like identify an archetype that's attached to our mental health journey. And I think that could really help people. Like if right now we're in a pandemic, we're in a civil rights movement, essentially. There's going to be, you know, an abundance of mental health challenges coming up more than ever. And maybe one of the tools is like, all right, what archetype is this mental health challenge expressing? And do I like this archetype? Like, is this the right archetype to work with when I'm trying to, like, you know, I don't want to say fix yourself, but when you're trying to, like you said, create contentment, can create possibility. And I love how you shifted from the sort of starving artist or the wounded artist to the warrior. And you found that the warrior was such a better archetype to work with when it comes to your mental health. You know, what's coming to me is, like, on the topic of shadow work, a lot of shadow work, I think, when it comes to mental health, does sometimes have to do with ancestral lineage, ancestral work. Have you found in your shadow work with your ancestors, was this sort of malaise, was that also part of the story for them?
Absolutely part of the story. You know, I was very like lucky to have a grandmother who really shared quite a few stories, and my parents are pretty open about what they've experienced, how their childhood was. And so I was able to get some insight into at least the past three generations and how they did things and how they functioned. And I was able to really come up with some pretty powerful conclusions in recognizing some of those patterns. Is there a pattern of depression? Oh, hell yes. You know, paternally speaking, is there a pattern of anxiety? Hell yes, maternally speaking, and there's also the paternal element too. So I was able to get some insight, and I recognized myself as like a product of a lineage of these, you know, states of being. And I've always somewhat given depression a cause, either rightfully or wrongfully so. And this is, I know that depression exists without any cause at all. I do, I know that. And I probably attributed my depression to many false causes, but to me, that gave me something to work with. It allowed me a framework that I could tackle. And when we talk about the warrior archetype in terms of mental illness, I never wanted to just say, well, I feel this way and so it is, or at least I really did make that shift. I was no longer willing to say, this is how I feel and this is how it's going to be. And like, hell no, I'm not accepting this. Like, this is not okay. And I felt very, you know, again, very lucky to be able to make that choice within an experience of depression. And I began to analyze, and I've been doing this for years, but I really seriously began to analyze and create connections between behaviors and conditions and socialization throughout the generations. I noticed that there was this, you know, this pattern of women who were, you know, homemakers and gave birth to many children and who didn't necessarily want to do that. And there was this pattern of also, you know, marrying someone for fear that couldn't take care of self. I remember my grandmother said she was proposed to when she was 28, and she said yes because she felt like, you know, maybe another proposal wasn't coming down the pike. And likewise, my other grandmother, I think, accepted my other grandfather because he was Catholic, and she knew that religiously speaking, he could never leave her. And she'd experienced a period of 2 years where her mother, like her father had left her. And it just, all of this deep trauma began to reveal itself to me through further research. And through that awareness, I was able to kind of heal those aspects in myself. And the painful moment where we recognize that despite our best efforts, despite all of our knowledge, despite all of our awareness, despite all of this, all of these choices made to be different, without the healing, the pattern is repeated. So when I looked at myself, I'm like, I'm doing the same thing. I'm living in the same kind of fear. I'm making the same mistakes. It hurts. It hurts in a deeply, deeply visceral kind of way. But, you know, in terms of, you know, ancestral healing, there's a belief that if you heal yourself, that you also heal the generations past and the generations that are yet to come. So it kind of lends a deep importance to this work. And it's like, you're not just helping yourself, you're helping your entire lineage through doing the work, you know, through challenging yourself to feel these repressed emotions. And it depends on how you, you know, on how you interpret this or what your personal belief systems are. But like, when you recognize that, it could be that you're not even just recognizing the pain or feeling the pain of your experience, but you're also feeling the pain that was unfelt and repressed by all of those who came before you too, which is why it can be a really intense experience.
Right. Oh, yeah. That, and I love what you said about, you know, healing. We misunderstand it because sometimes healing is just having awareness. That sometimes that's all it takes. And once you have the awareness, you have the truth of, like you said, your own patterns. And then you kind of have this moment where it's like, oh my God, like I am my grandma, or like I am my great grandma. I'm repeating their patterns. And once you know that you're doing that, now you have the responsibility to not do that and to kind of shift going forth. But like you said, like the ancestral healing work specifically, which I feel is like the ancestral healing is kind of like a subsect of shadow work almost. like I don't know if there's like branches of shadow work, but I feel like that's a big branch of shadow work. And it's difficult because, like you said, like we don't want to feel the pain of our ancestors. We don't want to even feel our own pain. And then doing the ancestral healing asks us to consider these things. Oh, you know, my grandma really settled in love, like you said, or my grandfather had depression, or whatever it is. Even the topic of racism coming through the ancestral line is really, really prominent right now. And like you said, it can get heavy. I have a weird question, but do you feel like you've ever been in a time with your shadow work, regardless of the area of shadow working you're doing, do you ever feel like your shadow work has made you depressed or has caused you to spiral, or is it the opposite?
I absolutely do feel that my shadow work has caused me to spiral a little bit, but it usually paves the way for a breakdown breakthrough. And honestly, I usually know what I'm getting into when I consciously choose. I think when I consciously choose to do the work, because shadow triggers occur constantly, you know, whether we're aware of them or not. And we can very easily like just blow past them. You know, each time a shadow is triggered, we have an opportunity to reflect and to heal that shadow. I'd say like most of the time, we say no because it's just, it's not convenient. It's not the time. And then we just forget. We forget about that trigger. Like maybe we're in a group family setting and someone says something and our blood boils, but like we're literally at a party. So we don't write it down and it just kind of flies away. But when I make the conscious choice to do some really deep shadow work, I know that it's probably going to get bad. And I did do some really, really, really deep shadow work, the past 3 months. When the pandemic began spreading and when quarantine happened, I said, I am going to do some major, major shadow work. And as civil uprisings have, cropped up across the country, I have taken out time to do some work there, to do a lot of work there, actually. And I knew that it wasn't going to feel good. But sometimes sometimes us feeling good is not the point. And a lot of times when we make ourselves feel good in the face of really challenging experiences or information, what we're doing is we are denying what is trying to surface inside of us. We are denying the journey that we're being invited to take. And in the interim, ignoring or denying that, it serves a purpose. But I think that that is what actually contributes to the malaise. And I think that is, you know, if you can attach a cause to the malaise, I think that's what that is. It's a cognitive dissonance. It's this knowledge and awareness that something's wrong, but not precisely what, because we are denying what continues to surface in the service of feeling good. So when we come to this point of like breakdown and breakthrough and shadow work, and this is what I do for myself when I am like really, 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 really in it, I tell myself that this is the moment of awareness. This is the moment of awakening. And for me personally, very shortly after that happens, I begin to feel better because the cognitive dissonance shrinks. The difference between my values and my awareness and how I act and behave, it shrinks. And that's what I think like integrity is. Integrity is when you act according to your values and beliefs. And when we are not acting with integrity because it's too hard, we feel malaise. We feel like something's wrong and we can't really pinpoint it. And it's because we're not looking at it because it's too hard.
Yeah, I love that. Wow. Yeah, I love that. I've felt like that as well in certain ways, like when I've meditated on sort of the spirit of malaise, or like why do we have this in the human experience? And it's exactly what you said. It's like we have low grade depression or malaise, or that kind of nagging anxiety that just is kind of there. It's not there just for fun. It's not there to torture us. It has for me too become this sign of, all right, there's like shadow work on the back burner that I'm not doing. And for some reason, I'm like either consciously or unconsciously avoiding this shadow work. And now it's going to like, you know, make itself present in my life in some way. And I think this is sort of the power of shadow work and witchcraft in general. We get the new perspective on mental health, because witchcrafts won't let you go into victim mentality. It really won't. Like, you know, you have to be responsible for your feelings. Recently I actually heard, I can't remember who I was listening to, but I was listening to a podcast where someone said they did not like the term shadow work. And I was wondering, what's your definition of shadow work / have you ever kind of become like, not, you don't like the term, like what's your take on that?
I really resonate with the term shadow work because it speaks of a phenomena. And it takes a physical example and applies it to a psycho-spiritual issue. So like when something is in shadow, it can't necessarily be fully seen for what it is. And when something is pulled out into the light, there's a greater awareness of what that thing is. So for me, when I think of shadow, I think of something that's veiled. And it's very similar to, you know, when we think of the moon, re the sun, a little bit of a veil, a little bit of a shadow, a bit of a reflection, something that is being asked to, and it invites us to look deeper. I'm intrigued by mystery. Like mystery sucks me in. So the shadow is very intriguing to me generally. It's like there's a glimmer. I can see a bit of an outline of what might be there, but it's not really until I pull it into the light that I can fully examine it and understand it. And that's kind of what my definition of shadow work really is. Of course, there are many different steps, many different approaches, but like basically it is just bringing awareness to that which you are unaware of in your own psyche that is causing the malaise and the cognitive dissonance that is causing you to be or exist in a way that doesn't really resonate or speak to your highest good. And I know that sounds a little bit woo, but I'm trying to think of a better way to even say it. It's the, you know, the trauma, the repression, everything it is that's very painful and what's taboo and rejected that we just push under the carpet or push to the side because it's hard to reconcile. It's hard to deal with. It's difficult to be in a moment of pain. It's difficult to admit that there are ways that you deviate from the norm that could be, you know, could put you up on the, you know, the block for rejection. But shadow work is saying, you know what? I feel like the benefit of this work far outweighs the risk that I'm taking. So I'm going to pull this out. I'm going to know myself better so that when I do act and behave, that I can do so, you know, with integrity, with a knowledge of actually who it is that I am and what is working subconsciously, you know, what's hanging out down there and emerging in ways that prior to shadow work, I had no idea of. You know, once you have that awareness, you have control. You can say, oh, I'm feeling this way because of that, and I'm not going to react. I'm going to choose to do this or that or that or that because I know that this emotion stems from this and I don't want this to keep coming up in everything I experience and then sabotaging me, you know, time and time again.
Yeah, because that kind of almost the avoidance of shadow work, you can't avoid it because not only will it result in some sort of malaise in whatever way manifests in the individual, but then that thing that you are avoiding, you will start projecting it all over the place. And then the world will also mirror it to you as well. So we think, our egos think we can avoid the pain and avoid the realization, but we really can't. You know, something actually pretty rooted in ego that's been coming up for me lately is sort of the kind of, there's such a call to action right now about, in a sense, individuals needing to do shadow work, specifically white people in this country needing to do shadow work. And I don't know if like everybody would call it that, but because we're all witches here, like maybe we can put it in those terms. But the thing too that I've kind of been struggling with is you can't force shadow work onto another person. You can't force someone into awareness, and then that causes you anger. There's like a lot of anger within me, like, wow, like I don't have the power to do someone else's shadow work but my own. And I'm wondering if anything like this has been happening to you, and yeah, how can we kind of work with that feeling?
Okay, so this has been happening with me. It's been happening with a lot of people that I work with across the board. And this is something that I've spoken to and something that I definitely, you know, work with in myself. And this is where compassion comes into play for me. And also realism. and when I try to actually slip into the paradigm of another. So anger is... it can be a catalyst. It is an emotion we experience, and there's a reason for that. Right now, in terms of like nationally speaking, we're very divided as a nation, where it feels like there's one group of people that feel and think all the way over here, and there's another group of people that feel and think all the way over here. And the further and further we drift from one another, or at least our perception of quote unquote the other becomes, the more and more anger is going to crop up. I try and recognize I look at things as a totality. I really do. I recognize the anger for what it is and I honor it. But I also do a lot of work, like I said, with compassion and relinquishing control. I can be known to be a bit of a control freak. Or at least, you know, I have been in the past, where I feel like I can control all of these things that happen. And, you know, the more time passes, the more I realize I have very little control over certain things. The anger and the action that results from that anger can help shift minds of people hanging out in the middle. That's what it can do. It can help catalyze action for people who are experiencing the cognitive dissonance, who have that something's wrong and feel that they're not acting in accordance with their values. Being vocal and acting can inspire action from people in that space. That's the hope, in my humble opinion. Those who aren't even close to the fence, you can get angry, but catalyze that anger into some sort of move that can speak to the people on the fence, because you're not going to get the people over here. You're not going to get the people who are inspiring the anger. Like, full stop. It's not going to be you. If it's anyone, it's going to be someone from their family. It's going to be someone they know. It's going to be the result of a very isolated, specific experience that they've had. It's likely you're not going to reach someone across such a huge divide. What you can do is you can reach the people who are waiting in the waters around you, who aren't quite ready to commit, or, you know, that helps for me. And I do try to have compassion in terms generally. Being a human being is really fucking hard. And we're all given different legacies. And most of those legacies that we're given have deeply fucked up elements. And I think, and I use that word because I want to drive home the weight of how challenging it is to be socialized in one way and choose to be different. It's almost like a rent, it feels, it viscerally hurts. Like it will hurt the being. So I recognize that, you know, some people might not be ready to do that work. And really, I can try not to be overcome with anger through having compassion for people who were raised in different circumstances, were raised with a different set of beliefs, who may not even be aware of any kind of reflective work. You know, like, we're all coming at this from such different places. And that's something that I do to maintain myself, you know, largely so that I don't become consumed in anger. Because being consumed in anger usually leads to paralysis. Or it seems, you know, if you're an angry person who's consumed with anger, then the weight of that is most likely keeping you from doing what it is that you actually can do. So yeah, that's my hot take on that.
Yeah, I like that. And also something that's been coming to me watching all of this, as like both a participant and a spectator at the same time, like, not everybody, I've been telling myself, I've been like, Mallory, not everybody has access to the mindset that you have. And just even that has helped my anger a little bit, because it doesn't make it any less frustrating. And we always wish, again, in a very ego way, that someone would have access to our mindset, because we want to be right, quote unquote, whatever that means. But like you said, like, finding small ways to step into compassion, understanding that no one is you but you. You're the only one who thinks exactly like you do. And trying to get someone to have like transplant your brain into someone else's brain is just not, it's not how we're going to change things.
Very true. And I commonly, you know, I've literally devoted my life to this work, and had from a very young age, have been doing this work since probably the age of 12. And I have made myself available to help others doing this work as well. It has been basically my life, and it is still incredibly hard for me. Keeping all of that in mind, I'm like, how must it be for someone who's not even done any of this work, who's not even reflected on self, maybe not at all. Remembering that too is helpful to, it helps me to keep perspective. It's like, how far have you come to have the perspective that you have, and very consciously working towards evolving and shifting as much as you can, you know. And this was, you know, not everyone makes that choice. So, you know, how can you expect someone who hasn't even done nearly the work that you've done to be able to just jump to that perspective?
Right, right. And is it in that individual's soul contract to even make this choice in this lifetime? Like, that's what I've been thinking about too. I have a question. Because we kind of wanted, or I wanted to bring up too, like, how we can kind of shift our mental health through ritual, through spell work, through working with the goddess or whatever witchcraft element that we want to integrate into our lives to sort of benefit us mentally. Does anger have a place at your altar? Like, is anger an ingredient in your spell work, or is that something that doesn't feel productive or feels too taboo? What's your take on that?
For me personally, anger is something that I feel, and anger is something that sometimes has a place at my altar, infrequently. I try not to bring it there, I'll be honest, because anger is something I don't have much control over, and I know that. And it is a very powerful, powerful, powerful energy. It can achieve quite a bit. So I'm very wary of letting anger fuel any spell work that I'm doing, because it is, I don't really feel that I'm responsible for what comes from that, if that makes any sense. So the first spell that I did came from a place of desperation and anger. And that was how I was initiated into craft, was casting a spell from a place of desperation and anger. And I recognize that. And like, I admit that openly. I did not admit that openly for a while, or at least I didn't like avoid it, but it wasn't really something that I spoke about, because I'm like, that's not who I am. I'm like a very peaceable person, or at least I like, but you know, maybe that is part of who I was. Maybe that was something I had to wake up to. But anger for me is an invitation to reflect. I almost always reflect before I do anything that anger has inspired. I prefer to show up with a different emotion when I come to ritual, but I would never condemn anyone for showing up with anger if that's what works for them. I'm not gonna be over here telling you that you can't do hexes or curses. Like, dude, you do what you do. It's not for me to decide. But I prefer to hold space for anger. So if anger is something that comes up for me in ritual, it's something I hold space for. It's usually not something I channel into spellcraft.
I get it. I completely resonate with what you've said. And I actually find too, it's not to say you can't honor anger in a magical context, but I do find that a lot of the times anger, at least within me, actually acts as sort of almost like unconscious headphones where I can't necessarily hear my higher self. I can't hear spirit. Anger tends to be a fuel for like the ego or the monkey mind a lot of the times. So I have compassion, like you said, like, you know, I can only do my own magic. And I think part of magic in being like the non-denominational witch that I am is like saying like, well, my kind of magic might not be for everybody. And there's some witch out there who loves to use anger, and that's great. But for me coming into doing magic, I think it's sort of like someone once told me, like, ancient like magicians or alchemists, they would come into ritual like clean of mind. They'd meditated before, they had just bathed, and they would only do the spell work if they came to ritual like that. And honestly, that's always resonated with me more. The power of coming to something neutral. You know, and again, that word neutral is kind of controversial right now, because it's like, don't be neutral. Like, you have to take a stance or whatever. Not necessarily talking about like our socio-political challenges. Those are times where I don't feel like neutrality serves us. But in the practice of spirituality and witchcraft, I think being neutral can sometimes go a long way with the things that we're trying to cultivate.
When you're neutral, you have, I mean, and this is not my idea, obviously, but when you're neutral, you have more control. You do. You just have more control over where the energy is going to go. You have more control over your thought processes, and you can be very, very discerning in terms of the work that you're doing. And it depends on, you know, how, even how you view the magical model. I think this, if you view magic as objective, something that actually literally happens and goes out there and changes the world, or if you view it as subjective, something that changes your mindset and changes who you are and therefore changes how you exist in the world. And there's, you know, the trickle down effect or domino effect from that. I think it applies in both cases, that like, if you come in a centered space, you are just clearer about what your intention is, about where things are going. And it can help you in terms of being a very conscious practitioner. That is not how I always come to things, however. Sometimes I just come as I am. And I tell people to come as they are too, because sometimes I feel like if we're trying to, and it depends, each person, if we're trying to come to ritual with this quote unquote perfect state of mind, that it may never happen. And it may just be another excuse we tell ourselves not to do a working or not to catalyze a change. But I think it's this awareness, this idea of awareness. If you can come to ritual, you know, fired up in a specific way and be very aware of that emotion and what it's doing, how it's affecting your ego and how it's affecting how you're viewing things, then I kind of think you're good to go. I don't mind going a little bit off the beaten path in terms of magic, though. I know that I personally cannot always show up to ritual in a neutral space. And so I'll be like, you know what, this is where we are today. And I will make choices based on that. Maybe I won't do something I was going to do, because I feel like I'm not centered enough to do it, but it's helpful and useful to have that perspective, because that perspective provides clarity in a way that being like really in the moment of an emotion just does not.
Right. Yeah. And that makes a lot of sense, because if we are integrating a ritual into our lives every single day, especially in 2020, and this ritual is meant to somehow like center us or even just bring us back into the moment or into our bodies, we can't expect to come to that ritual every day in the most like meditative, like Buddhist yogi mindset. Like, it's just not going to work out. For you, I know I've noticed in my own life that my coping mechanisms have needed to evolve in 2020 for a lot of different reasons. And I'm wondering, you know, has your ritual, which I feel like your rituals, your daily rituals are sort of like mental health coping mechanisms, or at least mental health medicine to keep you where you want to be mentally. Have those started to evolve, or have you kind of found the same old is still working?
So when it comes to ritual for me, I am always pretty flexible and fluid, and I give myself what I need in the moment. Why do I do this? Because even when I come to ritual with a very specific plan, I usually somewhat deviate. But I like to have a plan. So I kind of, you know, I try and come with a plan and an idea and a focal point, and then allow things to happen organically, because I've come from both places. I've come, like, show up to ritual and just let things happen spontaneously, which can sometimes be incredibly magical. And I've also come with a very strict plan, and I'm like, I'm going to follow it from beginning to end. And like, I've done all those things and then maybe wasn't even really moved in the process because I was so concentrated on doing the steps properly. But in terms of how my ritual has shifted, I guess it's hard. It hasn't shifted in any specific way. I've begun to incorporate different symbols as they arise. I rely a lot on synchronicity to kind of guide me there. Right now I actually have a pineapple top on my altar because we ate a pineapple and my daughter is just like, here's this pineapple for your altar. And I was like, okay. And I just like put it on a plate, did some research about pineapples, and found something about them being, like, you know, maybe the feminist symbol that we need, which is really interesting too. So I guess how is my, it's not that the ritual itself changes, it's the focus changes for me. It's always, what is it that I'm working on? That has shifted. I've begun to focus less on myself as vehicle of abundance, I guess, and more as vehicle of emotional, overwhelming, and sometimes sublime emotional experience. So I try to let what I'm experiencing and processing guide the decisions that I make, and in many areas of life. And even that is still filtered through logic. It's just complex layers of very personal choices, I guess, which is probably why the courses that I offer and the material that I offer is incredibly personalizable, if that's even a word. Because the approach is just like, here's a basic structure you can use, and, like, you know, the actual materials and the approach, like that is going to come down to where you are in the moment, what it is that you want to work on. And you know, the idea is to ask the right questions and then proceed based on the answers and the insight received. So it's for me, ritual is an ever-shifting process. The focal point changes. You know, what I'm actually doing changes, and how I'm doing it changes and evolves as I change and evolve. It's very, very abstract, and I wish I could give something a little bit more specific. I do follow the cycles of the moon. I do actually take my own courses, so I do that. Like, I do go through that process. It's the same process every single month, and with magic, it's the same structural approach, but how it looks is very, very different month to month, depending on what it is that I feel like I need to focus on.
Right. Yeah. I like what you said, though, because even if the focal point is changing, it's only because our emotions are changing day by day. And even for my daily ritual, which is sort of like, lately for the past like 3 months or so, it has been surrounding the intention of self-belief, like believing that, you know, I can do this, or I can overcome this mental health challenge, or I can put out this offering or whatever it may be. It's almost it's almost like an imposter syndrome, be gone kind of intention. You know, but even having that intention every day, showing up to my little ritual, the emotions change every day. Like, sometimes I feel, okay, cool, I've got this. I don't need to even do this spell anymore. Like, we're good. And then, like, you won't light your candle for like a week, and then it's like, you know, it's just like you're like going down, and like you're like, oh wait, like I wasn't done with that, like I need to go back to that. So I think we always need to feel our way through anything, and that's why I like your courses so much. They're not like grandma witchcraft's like recipe book, like step one, step two, step three. Like, I think you allow so much space for the witch, no matter how inexperienced or experienced the witch may be who's taking your course, you really allow a lot of space for like creativity, which makes it more powerful. I always say I think spells are more powerful when you're able to sort of invent your own. But maybe you could tell us a little bit, because you've put out quite a few courses in 2020. Maybe you could give us a little bit of like each one, in case there's someone listening who's really vibing with the whole like, yes, I want to use magic more. Like, guide us on your sort of menu.
Okay. So basically, after doing tarot readings primarily for a very long time, I discovered that I just couldn't serve as many people as I felt like I could potentially in that way. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to just basically take everything that I've actually done over the period that I've been a witch, boil it down, and kind of offer it as a package for people who are looking to create their own practice specifically. Like, I am not like, I'm not a guru. I'm not going to come in and say you have to do A, B, C, and D, because I think that's restrictive. I think that that's trying to take control over another practitioner's power. It is just not, I think it feeds the ego a lot to be like, oh, here's the very one way that you can do something. That is ego service. It's like, I know the one way. You must do the thing that's the one way. And that's a little bit of a pet peeve of mine in terms of some of the approaches within the magical community. But anyway, I digress. So what I did was I created two courses, one that speaks to spellcraft specifically, and one that speaks to the ritual process specifically. And the first one, Spellbound, is a course that really seeks to give you an idea and a deep understanding of what spells are, how they work, so that when you approach your spellcraft, you can come to it with a deep awareness of what a spell is and what it's going to do for you, what its limitations are, and it really invites you to actively engage and be a part of the process. Like, you're not just, you know, like you said, you're not just like, oh, here's, I'm gonna light this candle, I'm gonna put in this herb in here, and I don't even know what the hell it is, or what it means, or what it corresponds to, and I'm gonna say this word that someone else created, and then I'm gonna be like, it is done, and snuff out the candle, and expect amazing things to happen. I don't think that that is realistic in terms of like transformative change, which is what I'm trying to do or seeking to do in my magic. So I basically teach the person how to do that in Spellbound. And in Lunar Alchemy, which is like my 28-day lunar cycle course, I guide people on a journey through creativity and healing, using the correspondences of the moon phases, or using the entire lunation. And we move through the dark moon period, the whole thing. I was going to list them all. I'm like, I don't need to list all the moon phases for you. It's like, I could, but we move through the entire thing. And we, you know, we engage, we make art, we do ritual, and I share my process. That was the course that I wanted to use to like, to let people know like, hey, these are the materials that I used, and this is what I created as a result of that in terms of my personal practice, to give an example of what it might look like, to make something a little bit abstract more concrete. And so it was my hope that I could just be able to offer this and say like, look, like if you like the way that I do things and you're looking to learn, like here it is. This will teach you this, this will teach you that, and it leaves a hell of a lot of room for whatever flavor you wanna throw in there.
Yeah, that's awesome. I love it. And I think, you know, so many of like colleagues, like tarot readers and witch colleagues, I guess we could call them in a jokingly way, we've all, I think, been pumping out the courses lately, I've noticed, which I think is awesome, because I think if you are like in more of a student perspective and you're looking to learn something about witchcraft or tarot or astrology or whatever it is, you can literally find so many variations of all of that right now. So I do like to bring light to a variation of a witchcraft course that I really, really like. So thank you so much for telling us about that. And I know we're kind of nearing our time, our ending time, but I kind of, in a weird way, I wanted to just ask as sort of an ending question, do you have any advice or any guidance for people who really feel like they're just arriving? You know, there's been so many people lately that have been waking up, or they feel like their third eye is opening, or they're being called into tarot, they're being called into witchcraft, and they're literally taking their first step right now. What would you tell them before starting this interesting, their own interesting journey?
Be prepared for something that will change you. Be prepared to learn things about yourself that you were unaware of. And also get started. And this is somehow, this is very controversial, this viewpoint, that I recommend that people get started as soon as possible. And I, every time I say it on the internet, I get someone coming at me saying, you obviously don't care about these new practitioners. That's so irresponsible. It's so dangerous. I feel that when it comes to the craft, belief is everything. And if you believe that something is going to be dangerous, then it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you believe that you don't do a spell in the precise way, then the demons are going to come for you. Then that is something that you yourself create. That's just my personal opinion. So there's been so many people who've come to me. I'm not offering them now, but I offered like new witch readings for a really long time, who would say like, you know, I've been studying and I've been reading for like 6 or 7 months. I feel like I can't, like, I don't know enough to do a spell. I'm not prepared. I feel like it's best to just rip the Band-Aid off. And maybe because that was my experience. Like, that was the first thing I did. I basically went on the internet, read for a little bit. I'm like, all right, got this. And just began practicing immediately. And look at me, I'm still here. My life is not destroyed. I don't feel like a curse has descended upon me. I'm not all about fear mongering either. So my thing is, if you're feeling like you're nervous, help your mind out, help your psyche out, put up words, speak words of protection. If you don't feel safe, do what you can to create a safe space for yourself, and then go for it. And you can enter, you can do it, you know, you can make your first steps very tentatively. You can just light a candle and hope for change. You know, like something as simple as that can be a spell, and it's pretty benign. And you'll find that, like, once you start, if it's something that's really there for you, you'll just want to expand. You'll just want to do more and more and more, and you'll want to learn more. And it will just be the beginning of a beautiful and fruitful journey for you.
Wow, I couldn't have said it better. I love that. And I think part of the reason we just scare the shit out of so many people is because that fear of the divine feminine, or however you want to call it, you know, that is so like intrinsically subconscious in all of us that we do start to get scared when we approach that. But then when we actually unite with that energy, we figure out, oh, I should have done this like years ago.
Well, and you figure out it's also part of you. Like when you take that first step, something that seems like so so foreign, you're just like, oh wait, this has always been there, and it's always been manifesting in a variety of ways. And now all I've really done is made a space for me to connect with this when I choose to, instead of, you know, spontaneously whenever it is that it happens. And then like the fear, at least the fear like evaporated. I'm like, oh, I kind of feel like I've been doing this in different ways my whole life. Actually, it isn't as foreign as I thought that it would be. And maybe like the method itself was something I hadn't done, but the feeling and what I experienced was something that I felt and experienced in a variety of ways. And that just, and that's, I think that's another reason why I'm like, hey, just do it. Because then you'll realize that so much of what it is that you're afraid of is projection. Is false. And then you're like, oh wait, this is just wonderful and fun, and it's a playground, and I feel powerful, and yay, I'm just going to do this some more.
Oh, well, that's awesome. And I think so many people listening will resonate with that. And I hope that you could kind of, you gave them maybe the push to go forth and do something. So Jesse, you're awesome. Thank you so much for coming on the show. And I think this episode is such divine timing as this year has just been so crazy. I think it's so important that we talk about mental health, especially in more of from a spiritual lens. And yeah, it was so nice to talk to you.
It was so nice to talk to you too. Thank you so much for having me on. It was a pleasure, and it was a pleasure to speak about this. And thank you, my dear. It was wonderful.
Absolutely. Okay, Jesse, well, have an awesome rest of your day, and we will be in touch some way soon. So we'll talk soon.
All right. Awesome. Let me know if you need anything from me or whatever the case may be.
Okay. I definitely will. Awesome. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thank you. This is great.
Before you go, I just wanted to say thank you so much to my Patreon supporters. You are all supporting the creation of this podcast in a bigger way than you even realize. If you want to know more about my offerings on Patreon, including access to the Secret Horoscope Witch YouTube channel, the link is in the show notes. I am a professional astrologer, tarot reader, Reiki practitioner, and psychic intuitive. If you are interested in working with me one-on-one or getting a reading from me, you can visit my website, horoscopewitch.com, to learn more about my offerings. If you find this podcast to be helpful, I would greatly appreciate your rating or review on Apple Podcasts. Your reviews not only make my day, but also increase the chances of others finding this podcast too. And if you like this episode, feel free to share it with a friend.